Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Good evening, everyone. If you enjoy our show and find our research both interesting and informative, please can I ask that you consider leaving us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does help us out a huge amount. You can also find out more about us and our work by heading over to deadsouls.co.uk and checking us out. We are a small team of 3 researchers with more than 70 years of experience between us. You can also find us and speak to us over on Instagram. Just search Dead Souls Social Club and we'll come up. So, as always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is Ghost Watch. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight. 33 years ago, a one-off television show, which would eventually inspire very early reality television and faux news, terrified an entire generation. The BBC would quickly disown it, never to air it again. The show was called Ghost Watch, the Halloween mockumentary that changed the landscape of television in the United Kingdom forever. Tonight's episode is a slight change in tone for us, but nevertheless something that we absolutely felt fell into the category of dark history. Plus, we have a huge soft spot for what we are going to talk about. So here we go. Adults tend to forget what really scares children. For Halloween, they break out monsters and witches, those old All Hallows Eve clichés. But many miss the point, unaware that what really terrifies children is really odd things. Things that look normal for the most part, but aren't quite right somehow. When horror writer Stephen Volk decided to write a television drama that would scare his 12-year-old self, he didn't realise that it would reverberate with every other kid who tuned in, too. As a young boy, Volk had been fascinated by a 1972 BBC Two television movie called The Stone Tape. Regular listeners will have heard me discuss this movie before. It's where the infamous Stone Tape theory is derived from, a paranormal hypothesis popular amongst some current ghost hunters and investigators. In the movie, which starred Michael Bryant and Jane Asher, a group of scientists investigate whether the walls and stonework of an old Victorian building have recorded its past events within them. The historical world embedding itself on the physical realm, destined to repeat and relive moments from the past for all eternity. Well, on Saturday the 31st of October 1992, beginning at 9:25 p.m. and running for over 90 minutes, the BBC on its primetime television channel BBC One played the biggest trick on the general public since the War of the Worlds radio broadcast of 1938. I remember it well. I was 8 years old. I had not long got home from trick-or-treating with my cousins. I was dressed as a zombie priest that year. My grandmother had made me dinner and the two of us sat down on the couch in the living room to watch a creepy Halloween documentary that we had seen advertised as the first live television investigation into paranormal phenomenon. This was the sort of thing that my grandfather spent hours in his study researching, reading and writing about, but something that he shielded me from somewhat at that age, knowing full well what a young boy's imagination could do. Of course, the more he shielded me from his work, the more intrigued and fascinated I was by it, managing to get a sneaky look through a book or set of photographs when I was in his study with him here and there. But my granddad was out that night, so it was just me and my grandmother. We were ready and excited for for what was heavily advertised as Halloween television's main event of the year. That night, after shows which were popular at the time, namely Noel's House Party, The Generation Game, and Casualty, 11 million people tuned in, along with my grandmother and I, to watch a one-off television special titled Ghost Watch. The television show appeared to be broadcast live from a house in North Holt, a town in northwest London. It was a serious, scientific, live television investigation into a family who were experiencing a malevolent presence within their home that manifested itself by making banging noises throughout the house, moving things, and creating a series of strange events in the house and wider neighbourhood. As well as a team on location at the North Holt home, there was also a presenter, namely respected broadcaster Michael Parkinson, in a studio at the BBC's Broadcasting Centre. Parkinson was a sceptic and was the voice of doubt on behalf of the general public, talking during the show to a paranormal expert on the science behind the phenomena. Meanwhile, back at the house, engaging with a single mother and her two young girls, was the children's BBC darling Sarah Green. Green's husband, Mike Smith, manned a bank of phone lines which were open to the general public in a style not too dissimilar from the popular factual television show at the time, Crime Watch. A live phone-in number would display at the bottom of the television screen during the show, so those watching could get in touch regarding their experiences or things which they saw on their screens from the live broadcast. If you actually called the number, as many thousands of people did at the time, you got through to a bank of real parapsychologists who were hired to engage with the public regarding their experiences. Craig Charles, who was a hugely popular actor and presenter, most well known at the time for his role in the television comedy series Red Dwarf, was the reporter on the ground, interviewing neighbours and other residents in the town who had experienced some troubling and strange things. Charles gave a slight comedic comic relief to the proceedings, with his tongue-in-cheek comments and slight mocking of the events, saying how much he hated Halloween. The first 45 minutes of the programme were rather sedate, a slow burn, if you will, setting the scene and introducing the viewers to the Early family, their house, and what strange phenomenon they had been experiencing within their home on Fox Hill Drive. Then, around halfway through, things started to progress and develop. The full premise of the show, for those of you who have never seen it, is this. Pamela Early and her daughters Suzanne and Kim are tormented by a poltergeist referred to by the youngest daughter Kim as Pipes. The spirit is called this due to it producing knocking noises throughout the house, particularly on the central heating piping that ran throughout the home. Pipes often harms Suzanne, who shows multiple scratches and cuts on her body and face, as reportedly coming from the spectre. The poltergeist is said to dwell in a small room under the stairs. Sarah Green reports from the Early's home. Craig Charles, whilst interviewing some of the neighbours, reveals the street's violent and creepy past. Parkinson is joined in the studio by Dr. Lynn Pascoe, a parapsychologist advising on the night's phenomena. We meet each of the family members, who individually share their chilling experiences, in a backstory which is not too dissimilar from the real-life Enfield haunting of the late 1970s. Suzanne is then discovered to be faking some of the knocking sounds. This would convince the skeptic Michael Parkinson that the whole haunting is a hoax. Suzanne, however, is adamant that it is all real, and she just wanted to ensure that there was quote-unquote phenomenon for the cameras, and so that there was evidence for the public to see and believe in the family's story. Suzanne then begins to speak in an abnormal and guttural voice, which is extremely out of character for her and not the sound of a 12-year-old girl. She then develops scratches across her face. Members of the public call in the phone lines and state that they have seen strange manifestations of what they perceive to be Pipes lurking in the live footage background. The backstory and history of Pipes is slowly pieced together throughout the show. A neighbour tells a story of Mother Seddons, a Victorian baby farmer who murdered children in the area many years before, And later, an anonymous caller reveals that Raymond Tunstall, a disturbed paedophile who was said to be possessed by Seddon, had actually hanged himself in the room under the stairs in the Earlys' house back in the 1960s. The caller claimed to be the probation officer of Tunstall. After Tunstall took his life, his body was then eaten by his cats and discovered sometime later. The events in the house grow increasingly frightening, bizarre, and creepy before Suzanne goes missing and is subsequently heard behind the locked door under the stairs. Pamela and Kim are quickly removed from the house by the production crew, whilst Sarah Green and her cameraman attempt to rescue Suzanne. Green is then dragged into the room under the stairs, whilst cameras and lighting in the BBC studio begin to malfunction. It is inferred that presenter Michael Parkinson, back at the studio, is possessed by an entity as the broadcast is cut. Many of the 11 million viewers who saw Ghostwatch were children. I was one of them, and absolutely terrified. Trust me when I tell you, I slept with all of the lights on that night, with my grandma sitting at the side of my bed until I had dropped off. Sarah Green had to make an appearance on children's show Blue Peter the following week to reassure young viewers that she was unharmed after the mysterious unseen force had dragged her into the cupboard under the stairs. 5 days after the program's transmission, an 18-year-old boy with learning difficulties named Martin Denham hanged himself, having fallen into what his stepfather described as a trance and deep petrified depression. He had become obsessed with Ghostwatch and was convinced that there were ghosts in the water pipes of his own Nottingham home. In November 1993, a year after the program's only airing, two doctors from a child psychiatry unit in Coventry, by the names of Dawn Simons and Walter Silveira, submitted an article to the British Medical Journal where they recorded the first cases of post-traumatic stress disorder caused as a direct result by the television programme Ghostwatch. Two 10-year-old boys had been referred to the psychiatric care team. One was committed to an inpatient care unit for 8 weeks. He would routinely bang his head against the wall and on desks in an attempt to free himself from thoughts of Ghostwatch and its evil spirit named Pipes. The spirit was seen only briefly during the broadcast in a fleeting background shot that shook many viewers to their very core. The show's producers, Ruth Baumgarten and Richard Broke, were hauled onto BBC One's consumer watchdog show Biteback to defend themselves over the show. Their aim had not been to mislead the British public, they said. There had been plenty of clues along the way that the programme was fake, they added, in their defence. Baumgarten and Broke stated that the preceding summer, newspapers had actually carried the story that Parkinson would be making his acting debut in the autumn. The Radio Times magazine had reportedly included a cast section for their listing of the show. And the mockumentary was also introduced by the BBC's Screen One drama ident prior to it beginning. Something, I must admit, completely escaped me and many millions of others across the country at the time of viewing. So, about those children. The producers of the show simply said that they shouldn't have been up. It was broadcast after the 9 p.m. adult watershed. For clarity, a standard of UK television is the watershed, whereby anything broadcast after 9 p.m. was strictly for mature viewing and not for family audiences. But that didn't mean anything. If your parents let you watch it, as mine and many others did, then it was fair game. Many of my friends, family, and others my age I spoke to in school the following week had seen Ghostwatch. No one who did see it has ever forgotten it. It lingers in the communal memory like an urban legend. The terrifying moments were different for everyone, and they were not always the obvious scares. Sarah Green shared a story of her childhood during the broadcast, of waking up one night to the sound of distant harpsichord music and seeing an Indian woman standing by her bed, her eyes rolling back in her head. I, and many others that I have since discussed the show with, Recall the momentary sightings of the poltergeist over the shoulder of the presenters, or in the background as the camera moved around the house. Those in the house seemingly oblivious to the manifestations, which made them all the more chilling. Callers would phone in and tell Dr. Pascoe and Michael Parkinson what they had seen, and the footage would be wound back to reveal often nothing on the rewind. All of the callers, of course, were fake. Actors, all part of the show, as was everyone in the house, the neighbours, the presenters, and Dr. Pascoe in the studio. But this was never shared or made clear with the public. In fact, it appeared to be broadcast live and was an entirely factual documentary investigation. The notion of the poltergeist, Pipes, was not an adult's idea of a ghost or spirit. He was a dark stranger, a bald man in a long black cloak buttoned up to the neck. Initially, the youngest daughter, almost with affection, pulled Green to the cupboard under the stairs to show her where he quote-unquote lived, personifying the spirit in a way similar to Carol Ann and the TV people in the 1982 movie Poltergeist. Those spirits, too, ended up being entirely malevolent, of course. Whilst the fake callers spoke on air, there were real members of the public trying to get through to the busy phone lines.
It was so chaotic. The presenters didn't know what was going on, and that's why it frightened me so much. I remember the moment when the feed cut to black and white. Then at that point I was sent to bed by my mum before any kind of happy resolution. I was left lying there in terror.
A friend of mine who actually called into the Ghostwatch phone lines at the time recalls. When the broadcast is cut, there sits a black screen and silence for a while. There were three people involved in the conception of the programme, which has never been shown since by the BBC, and taking almost 30 years to be released on DVD and Blu-ray. Stephen Volk, the writer of the show, hails from my hometown in Wales. Volk is credited as having written William Friedkin's The Guardian in 1990 and Ken Russell's Gothic in 1986. Amongst those movies, he has also published a number of novels too. He admits that he has somewhat of a darker side to his passions, and horror deeply connects with him, he said in a 2014 interview.
Horror is not created by violent people, it is created by neurotics. We all see the world as a scary place, in my opinion. Stephen King put it this way: we don't exorcise our fears by writing, we exorcise them.
The final script for Ghostwatch, which Volk submitted to the BBC in June 1992, well, he actually thought the BBC would reject it outright as being too risque for them. He was actually gobsmacked when they gave it the green light. Initially, Volk conceived Ghostwatch as a six-part drama, an exercise in pretending, if you will.
What is the biggest philosophical question for human beings? Is there life after death? And what would a TV company do with that existential question? Well, they'd turn it into a show with stupid phone-ins, stupid experts and stuff to fill in the boring bits. So I wrote that. I wanted the whole nation to be terrified.
Leslie Manning, who directed Ghostwatch, is slight and softly spoken. In 1992, the language of television was changing. Manning, when she read the script for Ghostwatch, was intrigued by the confusing crossover between drama and documentary. There was a new early evening rescue show at the time called 999, which was hugely popular. It featured dramatic reconstructions of bloody real-life accidents and emergencies, all set against sober commentary and storytelling. Crime Watch was similar, a television show offering reconstructions of the UK's most notorious crimes with a live phone-in where the public contributed information in the hope of catching the perpetrators of those crimes. It always ended with the presenter, Nick Ross, saying, quote, "Don't have nightmares." In fact, Nick Ross was actually approached to present Ghostwatch, but the BBC changed their mind and then wouldn't release him, worried that it would take away his legitimacy from his Crime Watch role. Fun fact, Vogt's early script was actually written with political journalist and broadcaster David Dimbleby in mind. But it would be events in the Middle East that interested the director Manning most at the time. Events which were a major influence on her direction for the show. Specifically, she said, footage of the Gulf War that she had seen on the BBC the previous year.
What I remember was triumphant music being played over scenes of British troops. I was appalled at it. It was so emotive and propagandist.
Manning has since stated that whilst making the show, they were careful not to use the word hoax. She preferred to see it as unpicking the language of television of the time. But Ghostwatch was, in many ways, a hoax. A project hidden in plain sight at the BBC. And despite what the producers have said, there was a definite aim to dupe the general public. The former producer, Ruth Baumgarten, works as a criminal lawyer in Ealing now, leaving her career in television behind her. She commented in 2011 that Ghostwatch was about resolving a crisis, and those first minutes and build-up mattered so much. I completely agree with this. But after Ghostwatch, Baumgarten actually received a lot of hate mail, with one particularly memorable letter saying that 200 years earlier, she would have been burned at the stake for being a witch. She was 6 months pregnant when the show was made. On BBC's Bite Back, alongside executive producer Richard Broke, she looked young and extremely uncomfortable. She simply wasn't used to being in front of the camera, and she knew that she was in for a grilling. She had gone out and purchased the mumsiest, most harmless outfit that she could find, she said, in order that the public would take pity on her somewhat. On that television show, which you can find on YouTube, she tells the presenter Sue Lawley,
"The reaction was far greater than we imagined. We were really naive in that respect. We couldn't have made it any more obvious that it was a drama, short of sticking arrows on the screen, of course."
Volk's script actually presented the juiciest and most intellectual challenge that she had worked on back then.
"Horror, if you don't get it right, is just too funny,"
she said on BBC's Bite Back. Baumgarten proposes,
"How much does what we want to see manufacture what is made? The denouement of Ghostwatch is essentially that there is a collective that wish to see this."
Thus, Baumgarten asked Volk to shrink the six-part drama down to one documentary-style factual program in order to get it through BBC commissioning. It worked. It was Volk who later suggested that they put the show out as a live and real broadcast. Baumgarten actually told Volk beforehand that the show was a huge risk and she was worried that she might never work again in the industry. Regardless, she took the idea to Broke, who she felt had a very mischievous streak. Broke was accustomed to controversy. His production of Alan Bleasdale's The Monocled Mutineer, about the First World War deserter, Percy Topless, was attacked by Norman Tebbit, the chairman of the UK Conservative Party, between 1985 and 1987. Tebbit felt the production displayed significant political bias, and the Daily Mail called it a, quote, "tissue of lies." Then there was his 1988 Falklands War drama titled Tumbledown, which also received a similar Tory backlash. Broke died in 2014. The budget for Ghostwatch was huge. The team was given around £900,000 to produce the show, which is about £1.9 million in today's value. This was massive for a single television episode back then. It would be shot on video to make it look like television news. Winston Ryder, the sound engineer for David Lean's epic movie Great Expectations, was hired for the show, and he actually created the sound of screaming cats by rubbing balloons together. It's the technology in Ghostwatch that stands out today. technology so new that it had only appeared on the news before, such as the pixelation used for Craig Charles's Vox Pops, the infrared cameras, which are relied on when chaos begins to break out. Those infrared cameras had only just come into use for the BBC's Gulf War coverage in 1992. It's the tech that gave the show that credible and scientific edge. Baumgarten and Manning had worked together previously on My Sister Wife, a 1992 television drama written by Meera Sayal. It's a film about a second-generation Asian Muslim woman living in Britain in the 1980s. Ghostwatch was, however, a step away from both of their comfort zones, a real risk that seemingly backfired. They were so absorbed in making it work that neither of them had considered that people believing it would signal anything other than success. Baumgarten actually fought the BBC hard against the drama label being attached to it, and also the cast list being published in the Radio Times magazine. Though, ultimately, it was the general public buy-in that she wanted so much. Neither of these things seemed to make a difference, however. Be careful what you wish for. Baumgarten later, along with Richard Broke, relied upon each of these things to redeem them in the public eye. It didn't work, however. The week after Ghostwatch was broadcast, Sarah Green received hundreds of letters from children who had watched her being dragged into the cupboard under the stairs by the violent spirit of a child molester. Many children sent her pictures that they had drawn of him, reflections caught in windows or shapes in the dark, all burned into the memories of the nation's youth. Pipes was that figure of fear, crossed with a kind of nightmare fuel. The strangeness of a man being dressed in gothic historic clothing. The things that are most scary to children are things that are slightly skewed. Because it was Halloween and because it was presented by a children's TV presenter, the children tune in en masse. The producers, directors and stars accept that folly now. Simply put, the children associated Sarah Green with Saturday morning TV, cartoons and pop music. Then, for the first time, she was there on Saturday night too. Of course the kids couldn't differentiate. Filming in the haunted house took place in July 1992. That year, it was a hot summer, and the building was wrapped in black felt to give the appearance of night, even though the interior scenes were filmed during the day. Close to transmission, Green and her husband, Mike Smith, attended a meeting at the BBC to propose a way for the programme to head off any possible backlash from the viewing public. They proposed a live discussion show to be broadcast straight after Ghostwatch aired, in a sort of Big Brother's Little Brother method that would become a popular format a decade later. Both Smith and Green felt that would have been great television. The idea was not picked up by the BBC, however. After the broadcast was cut and the silent black screen had played out, the BBC TV continuity announcer simply announced with a somber tone, quote, "And now, match of the day." Heading straight into the football highlight show as though nothing had happened. The BBC felt that people will know it's a fake TV drama because it says Screen 1 at the beginning. They didn't consider those who had tuned in late and believed it was an actual live broadcast, however. These comments, in retrospect of course, given how it was obvious and entirely clear that the producers, the BBC, the director, and all of the stars rather disingenuously wanted the public to believe it was all real. Today it's the actors who date Ghostwatch, and the presenters who help it retain its strange power. Craig Charles, with his outspoken everyman insensitivity, would further unsettle the audience, giving the stories and events believability, because he was a skeptic too, who made light of the backstory, as most people would in such a situation. But above all, the success of the hoax was down to Parkinson, who hit a mind-bending register unfamiliar to a television audience. Here was a well-known and entirely serious journalist presenting a complete falsehood as fact. with a scepticism that reassured you that the whole thing was probably nonsense, which it then proved not to be, and caught you completely off guard. When the eldest daughter in the program is caught faking the ghost's banging, with entirely real scorn straining his newsreader delivery, Parkinson sneers, quote, "We set out to catch a ghost, and what we have captured instead is the remarkable instance of a hoax." It sold many more on the realism. The phone-in format also enhances the banal realism of his reactions, him often looking absently at the surveillance screens. He touches a finger to an earpiece to listen to a time-wasting caller too. What makes reality more real than skepticism, fakery, and debunking? Parkinson, who passed away in 2023, later commented and felt that Ghostwatch was a, quote, "It was a pretty terrible show, wasn't it?" Like Sarah Green, he had dreams of acting as a youth, and this was their attempt that very much deterred both of them from repeating their experience. Leslie Manning says that what Parkinson did with his role on Ghostwatch was auto-cue and deliver a natural and respectable interview. So they tapped into this, really took advantage of that and ran with it. All the actors had scripts, but Michael Parkinson just ad-libbed all of his lines. It's his dryness that makes it. At the show's end, Parkinson wanders across a darkened studio struggling to explain what had just happened. The finale was so dramatic, it reassured a lot of viewers that the program was real. Then all those children were sent to bed. In the news of the World newspaper the following day, on Sunday, the 1st of November, a headline signaled the start of the predicted incoming storm. It read, quote, "Parky panned for Halloween fright." It turns out that hundreds of viewers had called the newspaper to condemn the television show. Many complained that it was wrong to show it as if it was true and factual. The backlash against Ghostwatch was fierce. In the Sun newspaper, critic Gary Bushell wrote, quote, "If you fell for it, you're either still writing in crayon, or you must have been overdoing spirits of a very different kind." The general feeling was of a colossal misjudgment, and many felt that the BBC had deceived them, something which they never thought the BBC would do. In a Daily Mirror article, Michael Parkinson was quoted as saying, "Anyone who didn't realise that it was a drama must have been living under a stone for the past few weeks," although it was all planned denunciation to try and play down the fiasco. Executives looked for someone to blame. Michael Parkinson and Sarah Green took the brunt of the flack in the press. Parkinson later said that the producer's reaction, quote, "showed the BBC at its corporate worst." Baumgarten and Broke were forced to appear on BBC's Biteback to apologise to the nation. Several years later, in the documentary Ghostwatch Behind the Curtains, which was made by Rich Lorden, who had seen Ghostwatch as a child, Broke revealed that he had directed everything he said on Biteback at the sixth floor of the BBC, which had been warned about the project. An inquiry was ordered by the BBC's then managing director, Will Wyatt, and a report was commissioned. Serious stuff. Jonathan Powell was the controller of BBC One at the time. Powell, now 70, is the head of media arts at Royal Holloway, University of London. He has not spoken about Ghostwatch over the 33 years since its only broadcast. As the BBC's head of drama in the 1980s, he had tried to cancel Doctor Who to tabloid outcry. He also commissioned the huge BBC failure El Dorado. Powell believed in popular programmes. Ratings were suffering as a result of strong ITV dramas. It was actually Powell who insisted that the drama tag and the credits be applied to Ghostwatch just 2 days before its transmission. He affirmed in a 2004 interview that the producers thought that if we did that, people would miss out on the joke that they were playing, entirely supporting the notion that their plan backfired and was entirely intentional. Powell left the BBC a year after Ghostwatch. The corporation had got into trouble over drama documentaries so many times in the 12 months following the transmission of the show. The BBC wanted to just shove it in the vaults and lock it away forever, never to be seen again. On Biteback, grim-faced parents voiced their outrage. One father stated that he was completely taken in by it all and completely terrified. Other parents claimed, in that show, that they exploited children and that the BBC had lied to the public. Outrage. Pure outrage. In 1992, the language of television may have been changing, but TV was still the other person in the room, intrusive and charismatic. There was, in the psyche, a strange sense that, unlike with the radio, if you didn't like what you heard, you couldn't turn it off. 2 years later, Margaret Thatcher's government passed the Video Recordings Act targeting quote-unquote video nasties, fueled by a Daily Mail campaign with stories of children being transfixed by what they had seen and emotionally affected by the horror. Of course, this was also fueled by the murder of toddler James Bulger by 2 10-year-old children who, it was reported, had been watching the Evil Doll movie Child's Play. It was against this background of moral panic that Walter Silveira and Dawn Simons filed their BMJ report. It read,
Case 1. This boy had been frightened by Ghostwatch and had refused to watch the ending. He suffered panic attacks, refused to go upstairs alone and slept with the bedroom light on. He had nightmares and daytime flashbacks and banged his head to remove thoughts of ghosts. He was admitted to the hospital's child and family unit, as his mother could no longer cope with his behaviour at home. His mother was helped to regain control in their relationship, and both were discouraged from discussing ghosts and his fears.
In the other cases reported in the BMJ, a common theme was the children's inability to sleep in their own bedrooms. Pipes had first manifested itself against the children's curtains, the most simple of childhood fears. An 11-year-old boy had suffered a year of panic attacks after Ghostwatch, it was also reported. All of the children were of a nervous disposition. All had parents who struggled to quell their fears. Edinburgh-based psychologist Silveira concluded, quote,
"The realistic quality of Ghostwatch may have prevented the parents from adequately containing their children's anxieties."
Martin Denham died on Thursday, the 5th of November 1992, after hanging himself from a tree in Bestwood Park, Nottingham. The young factory worker was 18, though he had a mental age of 13 and a sensitive disposition. His girlfriend told the Sun newspaper that the program had petrified him. His stepfather also said that he had been hypnotized by it. In a note found in his pocket, he had written, quote,
"Mother, please do not be upset. If there are ghosts, then I will now become one. I will always be with you as one."
His parents, April and Percy Denham, have always blamed the BBC for their son's death. During all of the backlash and flack, Leslie Manning entered into correspondence with a number of children. One letter from a girl who hadn't been allowed to watch the show suggests the hold that the program had taken in the popular imagination. She wrote, quote, "If it comes back on, I will try to watch it. My mum will probably say no, so I will ask my dad. If he says no, then I will scream." The BFI released Ghostwatch on DVD and Blu-ray in 2022. It has become hugely popular amongst Generation X and Millennials, those who were young and terrified by it as children. They have formed online fan groups, organised anniversary screenings, and purchased the mockumentary in the thousands. Films in a similar vein since, like The Blair Witch Project and Paranormal Activity, has meant that the fake documentary, or found footage style, is now a well-known and respected horror trope. Ghostwatch couldn't be made now, however. It would likely be more difficult for the public to accept and believe. No one would fall for it. It couldn't withstand the exposure and analysis of social media. This is because the ritual of TV watching has changed, as has the nature of outrage. 30 years of desensitization to media will do that. Children's exposure to violence is too large and common now. When I recently re-watched Ghost Watch and caught the momentary glimpses of the ghost, it still sent a brief chill down my spine. Not because the show still holds up. Sadly, it doesn't. It's aged and dated, and now, as an adult, it's clearly all fake. But the chill was from the memories of terror I had as a child, believing the show was entirely real and buying into the hype. Even though Ghost Watch faced a tremendous amount of backlash back in 1992, I have a soft spot for it today, and it holds a proud position in my horror Blu-ray collection. If you haven't seen it, I urge you to. And if you can view it for the first time through an early 90s lens, then I strongly suggest that you do just that. I'm also a little bit jealous of you for it, too. So, in aid of helping you achieve this, we are looking to give away a copy of Ghost Watch on Blu-ray. Our first ever Dead Souls competition, if you will. All you have to do to be in with a chance of winning this awesomely spooky prize is follow us on Instagram at dead_souls_podcast and DM us there with the name of the fictional street that the family in Ghostwatch live on. We'll choose a random winner on June 5th and notify you by return DM. While you're at it, why not head over to our Patreon and join up too? For just $2 a month, you get access to extra episodes, blogs, research material, and more. A hell of a bargain. Head over to www.patreon.com/deadsouls. I'll see you there. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.